This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhaib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Appointing somebody who has failed to turn around the Zimbabwean economy, being deputized by his son. And how is he going to supervise, you know, his son because of issues of conflict of interest? It's just like the dead end.
That was Elliot Masote, professor of business at Devry University in Ohio, on Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa appointing his son as the deputy finance minister. Details coming up. Also, the death toll from flooding in Libya is rising fast, with an estimated 10,000 people missing, and nearly 3,000 are reported dead from Morocco's devastating earthquake. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies today said the death toll in Libya's devastating floods will rise rapidly. Tamer Ramadan is the Red Cross, Red Crescent Libya country representative.
The death toll is huge, and it might reach to thousands. But what we can confirm now that thousands of people have lost their lives, thousands of people has lost their homes, and thousands of families are stranded or lost. So the total number of each of these will be finalized by our assessment teams on the ground.
Ramadan was speaking via video link to reporters at the United Nations in Geneva. Mediterranean storm Danielle swept into Libya on Saturday night. Two dams in the east collapsed in the heavy rains. Officials in the eastern city of Derna buried at least 700 people. Ramadan said a massive influx of aid is needed.
However, the humanitarian needs are huge and much more beyond the abilities of the Libyan Red Crescent and even beyond the abilities of the government. That's why the government in the East has issued the international appeal for support from their side. From our side, as International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent, we are also launching an emergency appeal very soon, maybe later this afternoon, to try to accommodate the huge and increasing humanitarian needs.
As many as 10,000 people are thought to be missing in the floods. Speaking by phone with the news presenter on Libya's Al Amsar TV Monday, the Prime Minister of Eastern Libya, Osama Hamad, said he was calling on all military units and medical teams to head to the flood zone. Hamad says the number killed now is above 2,000, and entire neighborhoods have been swept away with all their residents. Emergency responders, including troops, government workers, volunteers, and residents, were digging through rubble to recover the dead. They also used inflatable boats to retrieve bodies from the water. Libya remains divided between two rival administrations, one in the east and one in the west, each backed by different militias and foreign governments. The conflict has left the oil-rich North African country with crumbling and inadequate infrastructure. The death toll from Morocco's worst earthquake in more than six decades is nearing 3,000, with more than 2,500 people injured. Search teams from Spain, Britain, and Qatar have been joining rescue efforts in a desperate race against time as the scale of destruction becomes clearer. The effort is complicated by the remoteness of many of the worst affected villages. Martin Jay, a British foreign correspondent and editor-in-chief of the online media outlet Maghreb.org, explains the challenges facing the rescue mission to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Well, it has made it more complicated and harder because in many of these villages on the foothills of the Atlas Mountains, to get them, you have to obviously climb an incline, but on many of those country tracks, those paths, they were blocked by earth falling off the side of the mountains due to the tremor. And sometimes they were actually burst open by the actual earthquake itself, you know, leaving a sort of a ravine perpendicular to the routes, making it impossible for vehicles to pass. So many of those villages were cut off even from local people. So it took a while. It took some time for the authorities to actually understand the real scope of the earthquake when they concentrated really most of Saturday, the wee hours of Saturday morning, completely on Marrakesh. It wasn't until sort of through to Saturday afternoon when they begin to understood that the impact of the earthquake was much, much, much bigger over a much broader scale, you know, covering a big part of southern Morocco.
With access routes cut off, the Moroccan army has been using drones and helicopters in a bit to reach people, but due to the large number of villages, it has been almost impossible to get to everyone in time. The top priority remains finding survivors under the rubble, a duty that becomes more difficult as time passes. How difficult is this challenge?
Well, I think the search for survivors, nobody's going to say it. Nobody's going to officially declare it. But I think after 48 hours, you're no longer searching for survivors. You're recovering bodies. And yesterday, I was with a team in Amazmiz in the south of Morocco, where the fire brigade and the army and a huge earth-moving equipment were trying to find the body of a young girl underneath an entire house that had collapsed. And, you know, they finally did get to the body. But I don't think anybody now is thinking about finding survivors. I think we've passed that threshold now. You know, now it's a different mission.
Martin, while the earthquake's epicenter was in a mountainous rural commune, its shock waves reached the nearest major city, Marrakesh. Many of the ancient settlements' buildings have been badly damaged, especially in the old Medina, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, where some of the city's most important landmarks date back more than 800 years. Can you walk us through the damaged historic sites?
Part of this area of Marrakesh, often referred to as the Medina, the building disciplines that were used to build those houses and the materials were very basic and very traditional. And so, of course, it was very easy for the earthquake to knock a lot of those buildings down. And it's a tragedy that we've lost a lot of that. And, of course, the part of the mosque falling down as well. But it threw the spotlight. The cultural issue kind of managed to throw the spotlight on the question of whether the earthquake was really all about knocking down traditional buildings. And now, as the days have passed, we're seeing that hundreds of these traditional buildings on the sides of hills have just fallen, cascading onto one another. And that's what's really called the big numbers. I don't know if you can hear in the background, but these are army helicopters now flying over the top of my house, going north, southbound, going back to the Atlas Mountains, doing search and rescue missions, bringing in essential equipment, materials, food and blanket, and often shipping out dead bodies.
Morocco initially delayed asking for foreign aid. Other countries such as Spain, France, and the United States, even neighboring Algeria, which broke off ties with Morocco 2 years ago, have now offered help. How do you assess the international response to the Moroccan disaster?
I think the Moroccan elite, they could have been wiser, they could have been smarter, they could have obsessed less with the geopolitics of the region and the relations that Morocco has with certain European countries like France, you know, which relations with an all-time low. I think history would have judged them better if they would have just pushed all these relations aside and just let as many foreign international countries come in, and especially countries that got experience. You know, we saw that with Turkey. You know, the Turks didn't waste any time in letting in the Brits, Americans, and some of the GCC countries. The other element of it is it's hard for His Majesty King Mohammed to ask Spain or Britain or any big European power for military assistance, because that then throws the spotlight on the subject of military hardware and what the Moroccans have and what they don't have. And that would be difficult for the Moroccan elite to accept when given that they would be projecting themselves towards Algeria as an inferior player when we talk about military means. So there are many nuances to why it hasn't happened. And, you know, and the little bit that has happened, unfortunately, tragically, is too little too late. I think yesterday, 60 experts from Britain, earthquake experts with dogs, I think if that could have happened almost immediately in the early hours of Saturday morning, we would have seen a lot more people rescued.
That was Martin Jay, a British foreign correspondent and editor-in-chief of the online media outlet Maghrib.org, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinawi. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has released its annual Goalkeepers Report, which aims to track progress on the UN Sustainable Development Goals. This year's report sheds light on the global maternal and newborn health crisis, which affects mothers across low, middle, and high-income countries. In sub-Saharan Africa, it is estimated that 390 women will die in childbirth for every 100,000 live births by 2030. Maternal mortality rates have increased in recent years in America, especially among black women. Melinda French Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, tells VOA's Leonard Moudou progress is possible in reducing maternal and infant deaths. Among other things, new innovations have emerged that could save millions of lives.
Well, we decided to bring this issue forward this year, the importance of maternal mortality and newborns, because the world has made so much progress on under 5 deaths of children, but yet that first 30 days of life, and in fact, the first day a baby is born, is the most dangerous day for the baby. And we're still losing 800 moms a day to maternal mortality. So we looked at the data from around the world. We have a number of researchers. One of them is Institute for Health Metrics. And we said, this is data that people need to understand so that the world can do something about it.
According to the report, the world has the tools and innovations to prevent maternal and childhood death. Yet these innovations are not reaching everyone. What are some of them?
Well, some of the innovations that we highlight are things like intravenous iron. A doctor in Nigeria who has come up with a way to do IV iron, which only takes 15 minutes for an infusion. And what we know is that it makes a woman less likely to hemorrhage during childbirth. That's a fantastic innovation that should be scaled up immediately. Azithromycin, which is a very common drug, something a lot of us use even if we get some other infection, it's low cost. It could be given to moms so to prevent sepsis at the birth of a child. One other thing in the report, we highlight 7 interventions, but another one is a very simple drape, a surgical drape that put under the mom right after childbirth, that it's called Emotive, that can literally measure how much blood a mom is putting out or hemorrhaging from, to know whether the doctor, the obstetrician, needs to intervene right then. So we look at these key interventions that can bring down the most death in women, and we make sure that all of them are ones that can easily be used in low and middle income settings.
And what can countries do to ensure that women in the most remote places have access to the care they need and to new innovations?
Well, several things that countries can do. One is they can make sure that there are enough midwives in the country that are well-trained. They can look at their regulations to make sure that these innovations as they come out, this one that's coming out from Nigeria on intravenous iron, that it doesn't necessarily have to be a doctor that gives it, that it can be a nurse or a midwife who can give it. So changing the regulation of who along the chain can actually do the intervention, that's another important thing that can be done. Making sure that women not only know they need to get to the healthcare facility before they enter labor, but making sure the community knows and makes a plan for that. I've seen that done in Malawi, and it's made a huge difference that women get to the healthcare center early. They can learn about other things that can help their children and their babies, but then they're not caught in a rainstorm where there's no motorcycle available to take them. That's when they get in trouble in terms of the delivery.
This is the 7th Goalkeepers Report. What is your assessment? Where have you seen the most progress, and where do you think a lot more needs to be done?
Well, we saw amazing progress on reduction in poverty. We saw amazing progress on reduction in under 5 deaths, age 5 deaths for children. Now, the pandemic set us back, and we have to be honest about that. It wasn't something anybody in the world was expecting, but we're starting to see people, you know, are definitely going back to the health system. We're seeing the health systems revitalize. So progress is possible. I worry the most, quite frankly, about gender equality. I see all over the world that places have made excuses and set gender equality back instead of the forward momentum. And that's the one that worries me the most.
So what is your message or the main takeaway regarding the Goalkeepers Report 2023?
800 women should not die a day in childbirth. We can address this. We know how to address it. And we don't need so many babies to die in their first day of life. We as a world know how to save these lives. And guess what? Every life is important and it's worth saving.
That's Melinda French-Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. She was speaking with my colleague, Lenok Mudu, from Seattle, Washington. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa has appointed his son as the deputy finance minister and retained Mithui Nkubi as the finance minister as he battles to rescue the country's ailing economy. Nkubi hasn't been spared the criticism after his economic policies failed to generate growth and repay foreign debt in excess of $17 billion. Elliot Masote, professor of business at DeVry University in the U.S. state of Ohio, tells me that the appointments virtually wipe out all hopes that Zimbabweans may have had in advancing the country's economy.
That shows Zimbabweans really should not expect anything new, because, you know, appointing somebody who has failed to turn around the Zimbabwean economy, being deputized by his son, and how is he going to supervise, you know, his son because of issues of conflict of interest? It's just like the dead end that I see in the Zimbabwean economy, and all hope that Zimbabweans may have had, those few Zimbabweans may have had hope in ZANU-PF advancing the Zimbabwean economy, is just dead. Because you look at the whole cabinet anyway, and he did not only appoint his son, but also his nephew into the cabinet. And you wonder why. And I believe that's going also to anchor some people who, you know, are in his party, because it's something new in the history of Zimbabwe from 1980. Of course, we had 37 years of Robert Mugabe, but something like that never happened, where somebody will appoint his son to a key ministry of finance. Is it not trying to protect and even advance corruption? And I think it is.
But Mnangagwa is saying, David Mnangagwa, he wanted him to be deputy as part of Parliament's youth quota.
Well, are many youths in Zimbabwe. There are many youths in Zimbabwe that really qualify more than his son being appointed to that. And, you know, it's another level of corruption. And remember, we had that documentary, The Gold Mafia. It's all about, so I think to solidify, you know, they are looting, to solidify their corruption, he decided to put in his son to deputize the Minister of Finance, such that things are going to be covered up. Otherwise, I think the worst you can do in politics is to appoint your son. We have seen such, you know, tragedies happening when such regimes end. For example, where, you know, Saddam Hussein, their kids being involved in politics as well, people don't get happy with that. And Gaddafi as well, people don't get happy with that. And recently, you know, Mnangagwa's wife was given a PhD this past week. And then this week again, his son, his nephew in cabinet. You can see the trend of corruption, where, you know, trying to protect corruption, trying to advance corruption. And yet we have a lot of young people who are so much talented, more qualified than Mnangagwa's son.
So what happens as we move forward? Is it the same old, nothing new?
Oh, yeah, it's the same old, nothing new. And if you can look at what is happening in Zimbabwe right now, is that electricity is right now not available. It was just maybe put together, buying some electricity from neighboring countries toward the elections. And a day after elections, we were back to the old days where there was no electricity much of the days. and businesses are again going backwards, not moving forward. And on top of that, we have this cabinet of the old guard. Some of them have been, you know, in some positions in government since 1980. So there's really nothing new.
The ruling ZANU-PF parties are national chairperson, Ofa Muchinguri Kashiri, was reappointed as the defense minister.
Exactly. And, you know, other than the Mutsangwa says, well, husband and wife, you know, being appointed again in different ministries. And, you know, the minister of youth who really did nothing to the point where Zimbabwe right now don't have a stadium for them to play, you know, international soccer. So it's just like recycling the old guard and then appointing new close people, which is not going to help the Zimbabwean economy at all.
That was Elliot Masote, professor of business at Devery University in the U.S. state of Ohio. He spoke to me by phone. Contracts between big pharmaceutical companies and the South African government show it paid significantly more for COVID vaccines during the pandemic than many Western nations did. Darren Taylor reports.
Health Justice Initiative, or HJI, director Fatima Hassan told VOA, pharmaceutical multinationals pressured South Africa into signing what she calls abusive agreements for vaccines. Contracts show Johnson & Johnson Services, or J&J, charged South Africa 15% more for each dose of its COVID vaccine than it charged the European Union. At a time when South Africa had one of the highest infection rates in the world, says Hassan, Pfizer Incorporated charged South Africa 33% more than it charged the African Union. Another HJI spokesperson, Dr. Marlies Richter, says Big Pharma exploited South Africa's urgent need for vaccines.
We all think back to those dreadful lockdown days and the anxiety about COVID and how absolutely desperate we were for vaccines. And I think that desperation created a power imbalance in terms of the negotiations that happened between governments and pharmaceutical companies.
The contracts reveal J&J charged South Africa $10 a dose, while others were paying $7.50. In a statement, J&J insisted it supplied its vaccine to South Africa at the final global price of $7.50. Pfizer also charged $10 a dose, while other nations paid less than $7. Contracts show the Serum Institute of India charged South Africa more than double for a generic version of the AstraZeneca vaccine than it charged Britain. The two companies haven't responded to requests for comment. South African Health Department representative Foster Mohale told VOA the government wasn't bullied by the pharmaceutical firms, but was caught in a situation in which it had to make illogical decisions to save lives. HJI says it thinks it's likely other African nations also paid more for vaccines than did developed economies. Law professor at Wits University in Johannesburg, Jackie Dugard, says she's not surprised by the contracts.
We are in the global south, suffering the consequences of an unequal world in which, of course, the global north is trying to satisfy the interests of pharmaceutical companies and profits and seemingly putting these above the lives of people in the global south. So it's very disappointing.
Richter says the excuse from pharmaceutical firms that vaccines were cheaper in the West because that's where they were made is not valid.
Those arguments often ignore the contribution that the global south has made to the development of vaccines. Many thousands of research participants were included in clinical trials, many here in South Africa, who contributed to the science and the knowledge through public institutions like universities, also using taxpayer money for the infrastructures.
The HJI says South Africa paid more than $730 million for vaccines up front without any guarantee of delivery. In some cases, the shots never arrived or arrived after they'd expired. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suwahid in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.